businesses think in risk. For a certain amount of risk, they get a certain amount of return. And what we are saying is that they have to understand Indigenous rights risk if, in fact, they want to understand the totality of risk that's associated with any one project. It's becoming more and more apparent and more important, I think, for businesses to screen for Indigenous rights.
Protection of Indigenous rights and respect for their rights to sovereignty and self-determination, including what they want to do with their land, is inextricably linked with protecting the climate. And so any commitments that are getting made by companies or investors around climate protection absolutely has to incorporate the aspect of respect for Indigenous people's rights.
This is Mission to Scale, a podcast that reveals the tools, mindsets, and strategies that organizations and funders need to make the most impact, because the world's biggest problems need solutions at scale. I'm your host, Dan Borelowitz. In this episode of our special series with Stanford Social Innovation Review, or SSIR, we are tackling the critical relationship between business risks and the rights of Indigenous and tribal peoples. What does self-determination and sovereignty mean for Indigenous peoples? What are common risks to businesses who don't respect Indigenous and tribal peoples' rights? And how can companies better understand the impact of their footprint on their stakeholders? To explore these topics, we have the pleasure of talking to Moira Burse and Kate Finn. Moira and Kate are the authors behind the SSIR article, The Business Case for Indigenous Rights. Kate is the executive director of First Peoples Worldwide, which Kate will share more about in just a moment. Meanwhile, Moira is the climate and finance director of Amazon Watch, a nonprofit that works to protect the rainforest and advance the rights of Indigenous peoples in the Amazon basin. In our conversation, Moira and Kate will talk about accounting for Indigenous people's human and land rights and how it will enable businesses to understand their business and climate risks.
The reign of terror that occurred in the Osage Nation in the early 1900s was driven mostly by oil consumption and greed. And that did touch my family and did create just ripples of hardship throughout our community.
That's Kate Finn.
So what it means to me to be an Osage woman is that I am someone who has received the blessings of culture and joy and indigeneity, but I also carry an incredible responsibility and, frankly, intergenerational trauma from my experience as an Indigenous woman. And so for me, I have the blessings of having a family that has knit together in a resilient way our story and our family, but it also means that I'm very aware of the precarity with which Indigenous peoples live every day. And I think that I have the ability to help push the needle forward so that myself, my children, and my grandchildren can live in their strength and in their brilliance instead of being called on to only be resilient.
And can you tell us a bit more about the work of First Peoples Worldwide? Sort of what's the most challenging and rewarding aspects of the work?
Yeah, so the work we do is really at the confluence of business, law, and finance to drive corporate accountability to the rights of Indigenous peoples. So it's really rewarding and fun to work with and directly with Indigenous peoples and Indigenous leaders. You know, we get to really, you know, boots on the ground, understand what's going on in a community. What do Indigenous leaders see every day? How are their kids walking to school? How are their communities being fed? What's going on? And I love working directly with community. And what we do at First Peoples Worldwide is we tell businesses and corporations how and why they should consider the rights of Indigenous peoples beyond just understanding how their work impacts Indigenous peoples, but how it creates material risk for them if they don't respect the rights of Indigenous peoples. So the research that we do is exciting in order to show where it is that corporations can come in and create risks for people, but also material business risks. And so that's difficult. It's challenging to make a business case, but it's really rewarding when it does happen, because I feel like we can have great influence in corporate culture and in corporate accountability that creates a better world for our people. And we really, one of our values is seven generation thinking. So every step that we take to create change with the corporation and create change in the capital markets, I know that my grandchildren and great grandchildren will have a better chance at things because of that.
Could you talk more about seven generation thinking? Where does that come from?
So seven generation thinking is a way of thinking and a value set that acknowledges that we as people are only part of the story. But in fact, we have a responsibility and a duty to act for those who are in the future. So for our grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and that we all are tied in this way. So the work that I do now, both the work that I do, but the spiritual work, the work I do with my culture, the way that I speak, the way that I interact, is transmitted and translated for generations in the future. And so it's a responsibility and a gift that I have for those people. And it's a value set, as I said, that many Indigenous peoples carry. But it's also a great blessing, because it means that seven generations ago, somebody was praying for me and was bestowing a responsibility on me and my children as well. And so it's a connection that we carry to our ancestors and relatives, and that I carry into this work.
The work that Kate and Moira do is profoundly challenging, but for the communities they work with, the situations they face are just unimaginable.
I really observe people turning to humor as a way to alleviate the stress and anxiety of all that they were dealing with.
That's Moira.
And community, I think, is the other thing. Having strong relationships, working through the tensions, but really striving for an orientation toward community and collective protection and collective support and collective thriving, as opposed to individual, me for myself, just my nuclear family kind of approach. And I think that's something, there's a lot for us to hear in the U.S. and those of us that are, non-Indigenous in the U.S. to learn from. Yeah, and for myself, I mean, humor also is a great tool. And I think just I continue to take inspiration from the communities and leaders that I've been honored to work with, right? I mean, if they can do it, I certainly can.
With their passion for defending Indigenous rights, Moira and Kate decided to look at the issue from a specific lens.
The reason that we wrote this article and the reason that we're working together to write this article is because there is a moment right now where the business community is seeing the value of recognizing Indigenous peoples and tribal peoples' rights in a new way. And we see an opportunity with the SEC in particular to codify this moment for the future and to really work with the SEC and advocate to the SEC to take advantage of this moment and to understand that recognition of Indigenous peoples, while it's important in a human rights lens, it's important in a moral lens, it's important in a lot of different lenses, you cannot have climate-related disclosures without understanding the impacts of climate on people. And so since the SEC is now focusing some of their regulatory power on climate-related impacts, we wanted to bring this issue to the forefront to them.
For context, the SEC refers to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. In March 2022, the SEC proposed rules to enhance and standardize climate-related disclosures for investors.
And it's just a great moment to provide context in this article to all of those companies who are now addressing Indigenous peoples, but also to all of us who are learning about how to really integrate Indigenous peoples into our conversations related to climate as well. So it really is a moment to provide context and understanding around Indigenous peoples.
So why do you think it's important for businesses to understand the business case for Indigenous rights?
The plain fact that companies have huge impacts on Indigenous lands, territories, and resources around the world. And so the footprint that transnational companies have is huge. And not all of that impact is good. And so what we are saying is businesses think in risk. That's how they think. For a certain amount of risk, they get a certain amount of return. And what we are saying is that they have to understand Indigenous rights risk if, in fact, they want to understand the totality of risk that's associated with any one project. If they are not screening for Indigenous rights risk, they will not know all of the risks involved in that particular project. If they don't know who is on that land now, who was on that land, is there litigation related to that land, whose resources are those, who has treaty territories, whose kids are walking across that land, how many police officers are on that land, who's going to take care of that land in the future, they are going to miss a huge amount of information that will help them to understand what all of those risks are. So it's important to businesses, especially businesses who are now making ESG commitments, so commitments to environmental, social, and governance issues, to understand that the Indigenous threads throughout ESG, and there's no way for them to understand what their ESG commitment means or to operationalize that commitment without understanding what Indigenous rights are and how Indigenous rights are playing out. So it's becoming more and more apparent and more important, I think, for businesses to screen for Indigenous rights.
Here, Kate talks about a case study they worked on at First Peoples Worldwide.
You know, everyone watched the controversy and the actions that took place related to the Dakota Access Pipeline that, of course, crossed underneath Lake Oahe next to the territory of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe.
For context, the Dakota Access Pipeline is a 1,200-mile pipeline designed to transport hundreds of thousands of gallons of crude oil daily from the state of North Dakota to Illinois.
That happened. We all watched it in the media. It was a huge controversy. We saw that there were so many people at the mouth of the Cannonball River. We know, and we did this in our case study that we produced several years ago, you know, the tribe said no to the reroute in 2014. And the tribe said, we're not against oil. We don't want the route right here. And neither the company nor the U.S. government listened or respected the no of the tribe. So that pipeline went through. What we know is when we did the study, we saw that from August of 2016, which is when the social conflict was most visible, that was when you saw security dogs biting water protectors. That's when you saw sound cannons being used. From that time in August to September of 2018, the proponent company's stock declined in value by almost 20%, whereas the S&P increased in value by 35%. So what we can say is we know that social risk is material. The company lost value. We know that they said that the pipeline would, in 2014, they estimated the pipeline would cost $3.8 billion. But in fact, in the end, as of the end of 2018, we know that it cost more than $7.5 billion. So that failure to respect consent, that failure to understand the position of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and many other tribes in that area actually resulted in a huge amount of material loss.
So ESG in recent years has become universally accepted by business, at least, you know, large businesses and large investors. So my understanding is that already businesses are listing a whole set of ESG risks around things like the environment. And so actually what you're asking them to do is just to add to a list of what they are already doing, which presumably makes it relatively easy, or easier at least, to convince them to do that. Interested to know if that's the case or not, you know, how you're thinking around that.
It's certainly true that a lot of companies, particularly larger ones, as you said, are making ESG commitments and climate commitments and human rights commitments. I think part of what we are pointing to is that the implementation of those words is often missing a really important component, which is like, what does that mean on the ground for communities who are going to be directly impacted by the operations? And so if you have a commitment that in broad strokes says, we care about the environment, or we care about human rights, like, here is a concrete way that the rubber hits the road on that. And we're not seeing those words being implemented. And they need to be, both to fulfill the sort of moral meaning of those statements, but also because it presents like a financial risk to the businesses and to their investors. And I think the other important component of that, and part of the argument that we're making, is that, you know, particularly as the climate crisis increases, should have happened many, many years ago, but we are seeing more businesses and investors like finally sit up and say, oh crap, we should do something about this. And some of them are starting to do that and shift how investment decisions are made and what have you. That can't just be seen as like a calculation around greenhouse gas emissions only. Obviously, the calculation about greenhouse gas emissions is extremely important and a crucial component of these decisions, but so is what's happening on the ground with the communities, right? Because particularly with Indigenous and tribal peoples, but other local communities as well, this is often true, like, are really good stewards of the areas where they are living and where they've lived for hundreds and thousands of years, right? So recent, you know, Western science studies have shown repeatedly that the best protected forest areas in the world are under the management of Indigenous peoples, right? And we have to protect forests if we want to have a stable climate. And so protection of Indigenous rights and respect for their rights to sovereignty and self-determination, including what they want to do with their land, is inextricably linked with protecting the climate. And so any commitments that are getting made by companies or investors around climate protection absolutely has to incorporate the aspect of respect for Indigenous people's rights.
So you can potentially, with these disclosures, help businesses save an awful lot of money, which you're trying to do. You're trying to tap into their own self-interest so that they then disclose, and that leads to other benefits for Indigenous people. But, you know, you're not doing this because you're feeling sorry for these companies that they're losing millions of dollars, the Chevrons of the world. So can you just talk through the sort of thesis as what you hope will happen? The disclosures are made, and then how is that going to ultimately benefit Indigenous people?
So certainly disclosures are an initial step, right? We are not trying to argue that corporate disclosures are then suddenly going to make the world a perfect place. But what we're saying is that the practice of creating the disclosures is going to mean that companies are having to shift how they're thinking about their relationship with communities and how they're approaching communities. And that also the creation of that information, so information like what communities exist in this proposed project area, what claims do they have to the land, what history do they have there, what have they said to previous companies that may have tried to operate in the area, et cetera. The study of and disclosure of that kind of information will also be helpful to investors, right? Because investors can say, oh, this company is like trying to set up operations on area that overlaps with several federally recognized tribes, all of whom who in previous years have opposed projects of a similar nature from other companies. This might not be a good investment. Maybe we should stay away, right? It's also a tool that can be useful for communities, right? Because if a new company is doing the sort of due diligence of a free prior informed consent process, hey, we have this proposal, we're consulting with you, what do you think? Communities can go and look at the information that same company has disclosed around its operations in other areas, but also other companies, right, and say, oh, we're inclined to trust you because of your previous behavior, or we're not inclined to trust you because of your of your previous behavior. So it's also really important information for communities. And then, of course, it's important information for advocates, too, like Kate and myself, as we're thinking about how we support communities and support the greater respect for Indigenous rights in these areas.
You know, you asked, you know, what's the benefit of the business case for Indigenous peoples? Well, it's transnational companies that are on their lands and territories that are, in fact, taking those resources and often in past cases benefiting from those resources without equal benefit to the community. But what we're here to say is, but for those resources, but for the people who have stewarded them, they would not exist. And so there needs to be a recognition of equity, participation, and decision making that goes along with the stewardship and understanding of those resources. And so I don't want to speak for Moira, but we've done enough together to say that our North Star is self-determination. So what we are really looking for, what I really point myself to and what we at First Peoples Worldwide point ourselves to at the end of the day is the self-determination of Indigenous peoples. And we do that through looking at how free, prior, and informed consent can move the needle towards self-determination. And when an Indigenous leader can speak toe-to-toe with a company about the resources, the communities, and everything that is in that impact, you know, that is, I think, where we want to land. And when the decisions get made by Indigenous leaders for their lands, territories, and resources, that's where we want to land.
Moira, I'm interested to know within the space, because you talk about sort of centering the Indigenous people themselves and really putting them as being able to steer their own destiny. Are there steps being taken to ensure that that happens from a practical perspective?
When we're advocating to policymakers or to business leaders, one of the sort of key principles that we promote is self-determination and sovereignty for Indigenous peoples, right? And one of the best ways to measure that is this idea of free, prior, and informed consent. It's a sort of a model for how an outside entity can ensure that they're respecting sovereignty and self-determination, right? And of course, if we are advocating that to businesses and to policymakers, we should be doing the same thing in our own relationships and interactions with the Indigenous peoples that we're working with. And it's hard and it's complicated, and I'll be the first to admit that, particularly for an organization like Amazon Watch, right, which is headquartered in the U.S. and we have staff, we have folks in the region, but you know, language, technology access, all these things make it really complicated, but it's absolutely important. So at Amazon Watch, part of the way that we approach it, and particularly for some of the sort of more like far removed from the day-to-day realities of Indigenous communities in the Amazon, we really strive to make sure that while we are helping the Indigenous communities we work with understand these companies, financial actors, international systems that might seem really far removed for them, and that we are always trying to learn from them about their needs, their desires, their ways of looking at the world, right? So it's a mutual learning process.
Could you talk a bit more about the right to self-determination? And I was particularly interested to read about this free, prior, and informed consent idea. Could you talk a bit about what that means in practice?
Absolutely. So, you know, self-determination is sovereignty. It's the ability to set your own cultural, economic, environmental, spiritual, and other priorities for your community. And it's something that a lot of us and a lot of communities take for granted, but it's something that a lot of Indigenous communities are still struggling with access to, particularly economic self-determination, the ability to determine what your local community will look like and how it's impacted, and environmental self-determination. And so what we advocate is that the way to elevate Indigenous leadership and to ensure self-determination is through the safeguard of free, prior, and informed consent, which is a legal norm set forth in the Declaration and in other standards as well. But free, prior, and informed consent is a process and it is a right. So what it does is allows for a process of engagement directly with Indigenous peoples that is free from influence and undue influence by a company, free from undue influence by a state, truly free. where the information is shared prior to any project occurring and prior to a decision occurring. It's not like, hey, here's a project, you like it or not. It's, hey, we're thinking about this project. What do you think? It's prior. It's informed. You know, it's a process that has equity and language access, in material access, and in all of the information that's necessary to make a decision.
Kate says that after a robust and information-rich exchange has occurred, there should be a moment of consent. By the way, if you hear the acronym FPIC, it's just short for free, prior, and informed consent.
Does the community agree with the plan moving forward or not? And that is the moment where Indigenous leadership has a chance to put forward their self-determined priorities. Do they want this project as part of their economic mix? Do they want this project as part of their community mix and their cultural mix? This is the moment when they can say yes or no. And what we advocate to businesses is that in order to really respect FPIC, it's not just stakeholder consultation. It is building into their operational principles that they might get a no. So they are incentivized to speak with and understand Indigenous peoples far prior to project planning, but in project design. And so we believe that FPIC is the safeguard of self-determination and the safeguard of rights. It's also the way to ensure equity in decision-making and participatory rights through a process as well.
And just to underscore, if the community says no, that means no, and that needs to be respected. And that's part of what these various legal instruments that we've been naming make clear.
FPIC sounds like a fantastic, rigorous, well-thought-through process. Do you have a story for where a business has actually followed it, shown respect to the local community, and then they've had a yes at the end?
The answer is I don't have one company who has done FPIC entirely well. I have a lot of examples where companies have engaged with Indigenous peoples and then decided to leave the region. We have examples in a number of, you know, we know exactly where it goes wrong. But, you know, the real key to FPIC, it's not just stopping development or, you know, it is stopping development. It is really economic self-determination. But FPIC really is this tool to engage partnership. And as part of self-determination, it's lending the ability for companies to understand what partnership looks like. And sometimes that partnership will result in a no. But there's plenty of Indigenous peoples across the world who want partnership. But what they want is equity and benefit sharing. Equity in the job, equity in the deal, and really to drive decision-making in a way that makes sense. So FPIC can be used in a lot of ways.
If I was a business leader hearing that, playing the devil's advocate here, of course, because I wouldn't think this, but I would potentially think, you know, there are no other examples then of going through this process and getting a yes. And so if I've got my heart set on a particular piece of land, it's actually safer for me from a risk perspective not to engage. Is that a risk?
Yes, I think it's a huge risk. And I think the letter we wrote and the article we wrote said it best. You know, we're a connected world. There's no way that a company can bulldoze or run roughshod over communities in another part of the world. And shareholders don't see that. And investors don't see that. And so I think companies really do run a huge human rights risk, environmental risk, and financial risk if they choose to ignore FPIC and if they choose to ignore the ways that they're achieving social license to operate on lands.
It sounds like this is hard for companies, though. Who's helping companies engage and get this right, if anyone?
So this idea of coming alongside companies and building capacity is something that First Peoples Worldwide has done for nearly 30 years. Our work is to build capacity, you know, with and for Indigenous peoples on engagement with corporations. So we have curriculum and we have partnerships where we build that capacity. But we work with companies as well. And there's a number of other organizations that do so to build their capacity around, you know, first of all, who are Indigenous peoples? what are Indigenous people's rights? And then how do you identify Indigenous peoples on the ground? Like I said, not every country recognizes Indigenous peoples. So a company needs to spend resources to really understand what their footprint is and who they're impacting. So that is work that we do to come alongside companies, but to come alongside investors as well. And the impact investors in particular who are committed to operationalizing ESG and making sure that ESG isn't just a framework, but rather truly a value set to push companies to resource FPIC and to resource their work around human rights due diligence and Indigenous rights due diligence as well.
And then you argue that corporate disregards of Indigenous rights not only harms the people and the environment, Indigenous people and environment, of course, but generates risks for companies. You mentioned some of those risks: legal, political, reputational, operational. Could you maybe give us a story, an example of one or two of those key risks and what they look like in practice?
There are a fulsome set of risks, right? And corporate advocacy stands alongside all of those different kinds of advocacy, so litigation policy and all of the rest. So we at First Peoples Worldwide have engaged with several organizations out of Anishinaabe territories who have opposed the Line 3 pipeline and have been opposing that pipeline for a number of years. They have taken their fight to state court, to federal court, and to tribal court. They have done every sort of political and legal advocacy available. And our work is to stand beside them in corporate advocacy. Now, the pipeline is put through and it is operational now. However, in March, we were able to gather investors to the tune of $2 trillion worth of assets under management to send that letter to the banks financing the company that put forth the pipeline to say, how are you measuring FPIC? How are you measuring your impact? And why is it that you moved forward without consent? And the strength of that letter is to show that investors are watching. And investors stand on behalf of Indigenous peoples to elevate these issues in order to see that they get rectified in the future.
What do you see as the biggest barriers to solving some of the challenges and actually getting this implemented?
You know, FPIC is hard. Going through a stakeholder engagement process and then building an operational process to respect and know is new. It's new thinking. This is not the kind of thinking that companies are used to. Companies haven't done this as to Indigenous peoples well in the past. But they do it all the time in relation to municipal governments, to other kinds of towns and cities, in relationship to state governments and even to federal governments. So what we're asking isn't necessarily new thinking, it's a new application. It is hard. It's hard to understand and to switch a mindset there. But I think that there are companies who are willing to do so. And what I say all the time is having it be difficult is not an excuse not to do it. Companies, by and large, know what stakeholder engagement is. And what I'll say is Indigenous peoples are rights holders. They're not just stakeholders. Indigenous leaders have sovereign rights and have self-determined priorities. And so the moment is now to switch that thinking and to really dive in and to understand what the issues are and how to walk through them well.
And you argue that the SEC and other regulators should require certain documentation from companies. What's some of the sort of basic due diligence that you would recommend? Some examples?
Yeah, so we know that the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and some other regulatory bodies like in the European Union are in the process of contemplating new disclosure requirements related to climate risk, related to how ESG investment funds are labeled and the like. And so we're proposing that as part of those processes, they incorporate disclosure requirements related to these issues of Indigenous rights and impact on those communities and the ways that those risks might manifest for businesses and investors, right? So that includes things like the names of any and all Indigenous or tribal peoples whose territories may be impacted by planned projects, right? And that's both of legally recognized tribes and Indigenous nations, as well as non-legally recognized, because including here in the U.S., as well as other countries, there are plenty of Indigenous peoples who don't have federal recognition, but have an ancestral claim to land and territory and to the rights as Indigenous peoples. Another thing that would be important and useful to disclose are any and all land rights grievances or complaints filed by local communities in the area of operation, right? And what the company has responded to that. Of course, any lawsuits or other kinds of legal processes underway that may be related to the project or to the communities themselves. And so just to specifically name one of the risks that we've identified around legal risks is that communities in the states where there is a more robust legal system for respecting Indigenous rights, communities can file complaints, and we're seeing more and more wins in courts. Certainly in South America, which of course is where I pay most attention, where courts are ruling that communities are right, that they were not properly consulted, and therefore a drilling contract or a lease agreement or what have you has to be canceled, right? And so companies should be disclosing to investors when any of those lawsuits are in process.
And can you just paint a picture of how this space has changed in the last few years and how you see it maybe changing in the next few years? Are businesses taking this more seriously? How has it changed?
So there's a couple dimensions of change that I think are interesting to look at. You know, the first is that in the United States, at least, we have had a racial reckoning since the murder of George Floyd. And since that time, companies have paid new attention to how they are operationalizing commitments to traditionally underserved communities, and that includes Indigenous peoples. And so there are more and more companies who are interested in understanding how their business impacts Indigenous peoples. And I mean companies writ large. So companies who maybe didn't understand or who are interested to understand whether their corporate branding is appropriate in relation to Indigenous peoples. So for example, the parent company that owns the Jeep brand Cherokee is grappling with the fact that that name is actually the name of a tribal nation. And the Cherokee Nation has said no. We don't want the name of our nation associated with a car. And so that is work that company has to do. So I see an increased interest by companies in understanding. And I think that that's good. And more, I see an increased interest by investors. Investors are really looking to see, as I said before, to make ESG values operationalize. And that includes, you know, respect for Indigenous peoples in all different dimensions. So I see a lot of investors who are learning more about Indigenous peoples and wanting to incorporate that into their advocacy, either through shareholder advocacy or just in their investment platform and portfolio. So that's one aspect of change. The other aspect of change that I see is related more closely to climate, and that is as we transition to a low carbon future, to as policies and governments incentivize moving to lower emissions and low carbon technology, more and more companies are having and understanding their exposure to Indigenous rights risk. So companies before who maybe could have had responsible sourcing policies are now incentivized to produce, you know, electric vehicles, solar panels, all of these great technologies, lithium batteries, at an incredible rate. And they're understanding that their demand will have an impact and a footprint on Indigenous peoples.
And then if we achieve all the reforms that you're putting forward here, if they're implemented successfully, what will the world look like?
I think were we to have a world where Indigenous rights, in particular sovereignty and self-determination, are fully respected, means a world where we are that much closer to solving the climate crisis, to having needs met for more of the people and animals and plants and what have you on the planet. Because when those rights are respected, we see greater care for the natural world, greater cultural understanding and participation. And that's a world that's good for all of us.
If you want to dive deeper into the topics discussed today, get a copy of the summer 2022 issue of the SSIR magazine, available on May 26. You can read the article co-written by Kate and Moira titled The Business Case for Indigenous Rights. A link to purchase the magazine is in our show notes, and of course, you'll find many other fascinating articles in there too. Before we go, we'd like to thank SSIR for the work that they do and for partnering with us in this series. If you love Mission to Scale, please recommend our show to a friend or colleague. You can subscribe or follow our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Mission to Scale is produced by Spring Impact and Human Group Media. If you want to learn more about our work at Spring Impact, visit springimpact.org and follow us at Spring Impact on Twitter. Thank you so much for joining us, and I'll catch you in our new episode next week.